summary of what we saw yesterday, we saw that a detector that interacts with a KM state, so the field is in a KM state, with respect to the proper time of the detector, and the temperature, the KMS temperature of that state is 1 over beta, then a detector coupled to it thermalizes, which means catches both money and populations to the Gibbs temperature, goes to a thermal state of the detector, a Gibbs thermal state of temperature equal to the KMS temperature of the field after interacting for a long time in the adiabatic limit, which is as long, the phrase as long as it's switched carefully, as we discussed yesterday. Before moving to the Andrew effect, right? This is a statement that we proved yesterday. Before moving to the Andrew effect, let's consider a little bit of field theory. Yeah? What KMS implies for a field theory before coupling, talking about accelerated detectors and so on. Just one last observation. So if the field is a KMS state with respect to partial tau, then we know that W being the Wideman function, tau tau prime is just a W of delta tau. And W of delta tau plus I beta, it's equal to W of minus delta tau. And we also know W of Z is holomorphic for zero imaginary beta, also imaginary Z beta. Okay, so those are the things we know if the state of the field is KMS. So, interesting enough, if the state of the field is KMS, the Wideman function, or the Fourier transform of the Wideman function, has a particular form, which is very useful and connects with very fundamental results in quantum field theory. So let's just learn a little bit about it. So let me consider the Fourier transform of W delta tau. Okay. So the Fourier transform of W delta tau, let me call it W tilde of variable small omega. I define as, of course, I used it yesterday already. But let me just write the definition. Minus infinity to infinity d tau, or d delta tau, being that being the variable. W of delta tau, e to the I omega delta tau. All right, and that's the Fourier transform of the Wideman function. All right, so let's analyze what happens with the, I mean, we already saw that though. We saw that, well, let's just do it in detail. We saw it yesterday, but let's do it a little bit more in detail. We have minus infinity to infinity d delta tau W of delta tau plus I beta. So I'm Fourier transforming. Let's call this expression 1. And then Fourier transform of 1 gives you what I'm going to write. Fourier transform both sides of the equality, e to the I omega delta tau. It's equal to the integral minus infinity to infinity d delta tau W minus delta tau e to the I omega delta tau. Okay? Well, this thing is trivially W tilde of minus omega, which you can quickly check with a change of variables to reabsorb the sign in here. Then you have a minus sign from this, and also the limits flip, so you undo the flip. And this is just trivially that. right? And then on the left-hand side, what we get with a change of variables that we discussed, the change of variables delta tau prime equals delta tau plus I beta, during that change of variables, this thing becomes an integral over an imaginary, well, in the complex plane, a line in the complex plane, d delta tau prime, w delta tau prime, e to the I omega, delta tau prime minus I beta, which is equal to e to the beta omega, right, e to the beta omega integral over that contour, delta tau prime, w delta tau prime, e to the I omega delta tau prime. And then we discussed yesterday that we can use the fact that that w of z is holomorphic in the strip of the complex plane from 0 to beta to know that we can close the contour, there's no poles inside, so we can get an equality between that integral here and the Fourier transform. So in the end, what this results is e to the beta omega w tilde of omega. Okay, so we had that the Fourier transform on minus omega, okay, if you want, let me just write it here, w of minus omega, it's equal to e beta omega w omega. That we saw yesterday already. And this is just more steps on what we did yesterday. Let's see what happens with the commutator. The field commutator, let me define the expectation of the field commutator. Let's define C of tau tau prime, by definition, as the expectation value of the commutator of the field tau tau prime on the state row, which, as we saw in class, this is twice I, the imaginary part of the Wyman function. It is also called the Pauli-Jordan functional, if you want. Distribution, actually, to say it better. Okay, so we know, so if w of tau, tau prime, is stationary, then of course the imaginary part is also stationary. All right? All right, so of course we can also define the Fourier transform of the commutator. Let me call it omega beta. Well, omega, if you want. The beta, I'll call it later. And this definition is minus infinity to infinity, of course, d delta tau c delta tau e to the I omega delta tau. Of course, this thing is the integral minus infinity to infinity d delta tau of w delta tau minus the conjugate of delta tau e to the I omega delta tau. But as we saw also, like when we defined the Wyman function and we talked about the Wyman function for the first time, what's the conjugate of the Wyman function, people? Can I write it in terms of the Wyman function? Do you remember? One of the properties. It's a very simple property, right? If this thing is defined as the expectation of phi, let me just call it tau, phi tau prime. So if I conjugate, let me just write it in terms of assuming that we have a trace class operators like this. If you have that, right? And then you conjugate, what you get? If you conjugate, what happens here is what? This is self-adjoint, huh? So what happens here, well, it's not self-adjoint because this is not commute. Sorry, my bad. If we were self-adjoint, we'd be pretty bad. So what is the conjugate of this? We change the order in the trace, right? If we change the order in the trace, we get rho of phi of tau prime, phi of tau, right? But then we can use the cyclic property to put it back as it was. And what happens as you get is that you swap the tau prime and the tau. So the conjugate of this is tau prime tau. You people remember, we actually saw that in previous lectures. Okay, so nice enough, then this thing is just W of minus delta tau. Agreed, everyone? That's what you get when you swap tau and tau prime. Oh, that's nice. Because that means that, maybe, I don't know if I should, perhaps. So, if you want, this is equal to W tilde omega minus W tilde of minus omega. So, the Fourier transform of the Pauli-Jordan, which is the expectation of the field commutator, is just the difference between the Fourier transform of the Wyman function and the Fourier transform of the Wyman function evaluated at minus omega. Agreed, everyone? All right. Okay, but that's kind of nice because we can use now expression one, right? This thing implies using expression one that the Fourier transform of the commutator is equal to the Fourier transform of the Wyman minus e to the beta omega Fourier transform of the Wyman. Oh, that's nice, because then we know that the Wyman function, Fourier transform, of course, of the Wyman function, and let me write explicitly the dependence on beta here for a Kamen state we're talking about, it's equal to minus the Fourier transform of the commutator multiplied by this function, p of omega beta, where p of omega beta, and thus this is the result I want to talk about, where p of omega beta is defined as 1 over e beta omega minus 1. Does anyone recognize this? It's got a name. What is that? No one? It's called P. I call it P for a reason. This is a Planckian factor. So this is the Planckian distribution, the one that you get out of the emission of a black body, if you want. So basically, look at this, because this is super cool. If you are in a KM state of temperature, inverse temperature beta, the Fourier transform of the Wyman function is just a function of the transform of the commutator times a Planckian. Now, I wrote here a beta in here. Now, if we are in a free theory, and we're talking about, imagine that you can define a Gibbs state. So think that you're in a cavity or something, and you're in a free theory. What do you know? Well, you know that what is the dependence of the expectation of the field commutator in a free theory? How does it depend on the state? Remember, C is the Pauli-Jordan, is the expectation of the commutator on the state of the field. If it's a free theory, what is that? What's the dependence on rho? What was that? It does not depend on it. So if you're considering a free theory, then you get that the Wyman function, which is fully given by the commutator and this Planckian, only depends on the state through the temperature in a Planckian distribution. So oftentimes people will tell you that a thermal state of the field is when the Fourier transform of does it work now? Because it's not there anymore. The power spectrum, people would tell you, oh, if the state is thermal, and the CMB, when you look at cosmology and people doing quantum gravity and so on, they will tell you, well, a state of the field is thermal if what they call the power spectrum, what we call the Wyman function, right, the Fourier transform of the Wyman function, is a Planckian, and then some proportionality factor. It does not depend on the temperature. All right? That is true for a free theory, of course. If not, this thing is not a free theory. And of course, keep in mind, if not, sorry, the commutator depends on the state in a non-trivial way, just what I wrote beta, but I wrote beta for some other reason too. This is because we're considering a Gibbs state. So sure, the commutator does not depend on the state, but this is not quite the commutator. What I wrote here is a tau. What I really meant is an X for vector of tau, right? This is the pullback of the commutator on the trajectory of the detector, right? Oh, well, no, forget detector. On the trajectory generated by the proper time with respect to which this is thermal. You see, I mean, the subtleties where they come from. And sure, if it's a Gibbs state and your trajectory is inertial, then you get that this does not depend on the state and so on. But if your trajectory is a non-trivial one and you're still arc EMS, then perhaps you get that the commutator will depend on beta still. It does not depend on the state, of course, in a free theory, but it may depend on beta, because the beta is associated with partial tau. And if you have a crazy trajectory, you will get a dependence on beta. That's actually the case for massive fields and the Andrew effect, okay? We will do massless though, but that's the case for massive. In the massive case, the commutator expectation does depend on the acceleration, because it depends on the trajectory. So it happens that for massless fields, everything is nice and cancels out. Any questions? So this is a little bit of field theory, so you can relate this with results that you've seen elsewhere. When they tell you thermal state of the field, and they tell you, oh, the power spectrum is Planckian, which is very hand-wavily interesting and nice, right? Because you say, oh, yeah, black body emission, Planckian spectrum, makes sense, no? Is what you would expect. Well, not so fast. It's true as long as the commutator does not depend on the temperature, to begin with, then yes, that is true. Okay, so if you have a theory of interaction theory, or you have that this is not just a simple inertial case and the commutator depends on the trajectory and the temperature depends on the trajectory, then that's not true. That generalizes that statement, if you want, that the power spectrum is Planckian if the state is thermal. Questions? Just thought it would be an interesting piece of field theory for you to know. All right, so the next thing we're going to do, if there are no questions, is the Andrew effect proper. Let me just check if this works. I'm kind of hopeful. Yeah. Nice. All right. So the question we're going to give an answer to today is the following. Oops, sorry. Does a constantly accelerated detector thermalize to a temperature T equals A over 2 pi? Well, we need to add when adiabatically coupled to the field vacuum. So that's the question we want to ask. So we have a free theory, free field theory, and then we have a detector interacting with the field. And we say, okay, adiabatically coupled is a nice shorthand for, okay, we couple the detector for long times as compared to the omega minus one time scale of the detector, and we switch carefully, okay? So that the tails of the Fourier transform of the switching are nice decaying enough, okay? All right, and if that's true, then there you go. You get the Andrew effect, phenomenological. No matter how many crazy field theory considerations you want to tell me about how the Bogoliubov transformation, no, I don't care. This is just, it's a thermometer, you see? I'm just taking an accelerated thermometer to the field. If that thing thermalizes to that temperature, end of the debate. To all experimental effects, you get the Andrew effect. Agree, people? All right, so that's interesting though, because that implies, as we know from the derivation the previous day, the death statement is equivalent to say the vacuum state of the field is KMS. Actually, we know it's already KMS. It's the ground state of the field, right? So we know it's KMS with respect to partial T of an inertial of any inertial observer, of inertial observers, right? Well, by of inertial observers, I mean this is the four velocity of inertial observers, this partial T, okay? And then, of course, of temperature, KMS temperature zero. It's the ground state. But the statement up there implies that this is also KMS with respect to a completely different time of constantly accelerated observers. That is the generator of boosts. The four velocity of constantly accelerated observers is the generator of boosts, proportional to, of temperature A over 2 pi. So this is the statement, this is the equivalent statement to this, right? Answering this question is proving, all right, if you prove that the vacuum state is KMS, I mean, of course, the implication is not both ways, right? The implication is, if you prove that the vacuum state of the field is KMS with respect to partial tau of constantly accelerated observers, then that implies that the detector will respond thermalizing with it, with a temperature A over 2 pi. Agreed? So this thing, this statement, implies a positive answer to that question. The opposite is not true, huh? But that way, it is. Agreed, everyone? So all that is left to prove now is that statement here. Let's prove that the vacuum state of the field is KMS with respect to the proper time of constantly accelerated observers. Shall we? Questions? All right. So to prove that, we need to check properties on the Wyman function, if you remember. That's why I'm going to use the other direction that I didn't prove, that I tell you. For Gaussian states of the theory, quasi-free states, as they call it in algebraic quantum field theory, KMS conditioning one-to-one with demanding that the Wyman function is stationary, the Wyman function is holomorphic on the strip, and the Wyman function is complex antiperiodic. Okay? So we need to work with this object, the vacuum Wyman function, which is, of course, the vacuum expectation of phi of t of tau, x of tau, phi of t of tau prime, x of tau prime, zero, where, in this case, the trajectory t of tau is that of a constantly accelerated observer, sinh of a tau, x1 of tau is 1 over a cosh a tau minus 1. I want it to be 0 at tau 0. This is a number 1, right? Because all the others, x2 equals x3, and in general, in all dimensions that you want, xd, where d is the number of spatial dimensions, are 0. Just with a loss of generality, let's take the direction x1, the direction of acceleration. Okay. So as you can tell, if you remember, we computed this Wyman. And this Wyman was, if you want, but it doesn't matter, it was equal. We computed it when we were computing vacuum transition probabilities, if you remember, the k 2 pi d e to the minus I k t of tau t tau prime, and then of course minus k dot x of tau minus x of tau prime. A little note on field theory here. This thing, in d dimensions in general, it's not a function at all. This thing is a distribution, and the distribution is a bit tricky. What is done usually in field theory is introduce what is called a soft UV cutoff, or as people call it in quantum field theory, what is called a Feynman regularization, which is the I epsilon, famous regularization, because this thing looks a lot like a delta, but it's not quite a delta because you're integrated on the modulus of dk after the angular integrals, and that is a half delta if you want, with other factors in front. So if you go full pure math in here, so if you go physicist, it would be, oh, I introduce an I epsilon regularization, which Feynman talks about, and people in high energy physics would say, oh, yes, move the poles out of the real line, and then at the end take the limit, and it works. It's actually a UV cutoff doing that. Doing that is adding here e to the minus epsilon modulus k. It's the same thing. That yields the Feynman regulator, as you probably know from your field theory. So it's a soft UV cutoff kind of thing in the Wyman function. By soft, I mean there is an exponential tail. You can write that if you want, and then you get something that is a function everywhere. And then at the end, you integrate that and take the limit of that going to zero, and you get usually finite results when you ask the right questions. It's kind of cool because this is kind of what mathematicians call distributions, right? Like the limits can be swapped. There's a set of test functions you integrate the Wyman over, which is the switchings and the smearings and so on, that allow you to swap the limit of the regulator with the integrals, right? In the case if you are full pure math, you just don't write this and you say, okay, this thing is a delta plus a principal. There are prefactors, so it's not just trivially that. A delta plus a principal value of something like 1 over the dimension-dependent power law. Okay, and you can treat it like that. This is a distribution after all. So you get a delta, you get a singular part. Why are you going to not treat the other part, right? That is also a distribution as a distribution. Anyway, either way, whatever you prefer. But as you can tell, these things become, oh, let me just write here, this is, if you want the I epsilon prescription, which is the same as a UV cutoff, a soft, of course, UV cutoff. All right, so what time is it? Yeah, cool. So as you can tell, doing this, let's see if I can do this. I want this. Oh, that was too good to be true, right? Now he's stuck. Yeah, question.
Okay, I don't know.
Yeah, no.
I might have missed something, but are we working in Lorentzian space right now?
Yes.
Why isn't there an I in the exponent?
Why is there an I in the exponent?
Oh, there is. Oh, okay.
There's a plane wave expansion of the field. If you want to get there, you take the field and write it in terms of plane waves.
Yeah, I thought that was an A. I was...
Oh, my bad. Yeah, yeah. Actually, you were more familiar with formulations that write these kind of integrals at explicitly Lorentz invariant. And we will get there, okay? Because we're going to do that. Because in here, so you can do two things if you want. You can just, oh, nice. I can plug in this trajectory directly, right? And then I have something fantastic because I get an exponential of an exponential. And everyone knows that integrating those is easy. Right? It's not. You get horrible Bessel function. You can do it. You can do it. Doing this is a nice exercise. It may take you a day to do it. It's a nice exercise of analysis. You end up with Bessel functions of imaginary argument. I don't know how much you've dealt with those. Those are fun to deal with. They're horrible. You can do it like that. But that would be very harsh on you, on yourselves. So don't do it. Instead of that, we can do something else. Why don't we formulate, you see, after all, keep in mind that these things is just the integration of the generator of boosts, right? So if we write everything explicitly in a Lorentz covariant form, a Lorentz invariant for the Wyman inside the integral, then things may get easier, which is the formulation in which you are familiar, I think, when you do quantum field theory for the first time, is how people write things. All right, let me do this following step. So I'm going to write the Wyman of tau tau prime for this accelerated case as, so I add an extra integral. I integrate over d plus 1 dimensions on k. So I add a k0 component if you want. And this is 2 2 pi cubed. And then I get theta of k0. So I'm forcing k0 to be positive. And also I get a delta of this contraction, k mu, k mu. And then here I get I k mu. This is a 4 vector. Well, no, it's the components of the 4 vector. Sorry, k mu. And this is the 4 vector x minus the 4 vector x prime. Well, if you want, these are tau dependent, of course. To abbreviate, sometimes I would call it k prime, but you know what I mean, mu. Right, all that I did is just write this. You know, if you do the integral over k0, you get this exactly, OK? People call oftentimes this energy conservation delta, whatever, OK? All that I did, from the point of view of what I'm doing, from the point of view of analysis, I increased the number of integrals by 1 so that it yields this. Now, of course, those of you who have taken, which is probably all of you, quantum field theory know that this is nice because you are writing this expression in an explicitly Lorentz invariant form, what you're integrating. You have the invariant element of volume and so on. There's a reason why I don't like to say that, and we will discuss it. I mean, you can say it once you know what you're doing, as usual. But let's discuss why I'm not saying that. I'm treating it as a change of variables. So let's do a couple of tricks here. The trajectory of the detector is time. So far, this is general. This is a general trajectory. I haven't used that is constantly accelerated yet. The trajectory of the detector is time-like, obviously, right? The detector cannot go faster than light. So that means that x mu, that means that x minus x prime, and please understand x prime as x of tau prime, contracted with k mu, well, sorry, with itself, of course, is less or equal than 0. Well, it's less than 0, strictly, because it's time-like. Agreed? Oh, I'm using that metric convention. If you haven't realized yet, I'm using the general relativity convention, not the high energy physics convention. So my minus sign goes on the t. Is that the one you like, or you like the other one? How many people like that one? How many people like the other one? It's all right. It's fine. Okay. So it's usually high energy physics likes one of them, which is the other one. And people in gravity likes the other one. Anything gravity related, we use the other one. When you actually have metrics that are not just flat space-time, usually we use the other one. Unless you're Weinberg, but you know. He's one of the people. He can't afford that luxury. He's Weinberg. All right, so then let me define the following. This delta I define as the square root of minus x minus x prime. And of course, if I write like serifs in my letters, that means they're 4 vectors. What am I doing? Mu We define that delta, which is a positive quantity. It's a positive branch of the square root that I pick here. And then I do the following. So we wonder, OK, what is? So this is so far nothing fancy. It's general for any trajectory or something like that. That what is, question, what is the contraction of k mu with x minus x prime mu? Well, let me put this down, not to have to write signs. Oh, well, we know that this is k0, t of tau minus t of tau prime plus k1, x1 of tau minus x1 of tau prime. And all the others cancel because, remember, this thing is not moving, if you want, in the other components. All right, so what I'm going to do is, knowing all this, I'm going to do a change of variables that simplifies. So you remember what you do when you have an integral like that, and this is a spatial dot product. What you do usually is let's pick the z axis in the, or the one axis in the direction of the x1, right? The z axis. So we can do spherical coordinates, and everything is nice. Use the symmetry, solve the problem. We're going to do the same, but in space-time rather than in space. So we're going to do a change of variables here that aligns x and k mu, okay? And of course, in general, in space-time, that's not a rotation. That's a Lorentz transformation, right? That's why we writing this in an explicit Lorentz invariant form helps, okay? But since seen mathematically so far, it's just let's do a change of variables that aligns k mu with x mu in the Lorentz product, okay? If we do that, the change of variables is, let me call it, I'm going to do a change of variables so that I'll demand the alignment this thing I want it to be minus k bar 0 delta sine t tilde minus t, sorry, t tilde t prime, t of tau minus t of tau prime. So all that I did, forget about the sine function for a second. This is just demanding, all the x lies in the zero component. So I'm aligning x in the direction of the zero component of the integration space in k. It's the same thing that you do in spherical coordinates when you align your x in the exponent with the z axis to integrate in space. So this we demand a change of variable that does that. Why do I write the sign here? Well, the sign is the set of all the changes of variables that we can do here, there's one that volume is invariant. It's the orthochronous one. And that's why this preserves that the change of variables, no matter the trajectory. You see, because the trajectory, you can go on the trajectory with increase in time, or you can revert time, right? And then these things don't work unless for arbitrarily going on the trajectory one way or another, unless you add the sign here. That's the only reason I have it. You can ignore it if you want. It's just to do things by the book properly so that this is a parametric curve after all. If you want to go back in the parametric curve, it's fine. This sign takes care of that. All right, so what are the implications? So we choose then, okay, nice. So that means that k0 bar I defined as delta minus 1 t tau minus t tau prime k0 minus x1 minus x1, sorry, x1 of tau minus x1 of tau prime k1, right? And then this thing, you have a sine function of t tau minus t tau prime, multiplying the whole thing. K1 bar is defined as delta minus 1 minus x1 tau minus x1 of tau prime k0 plus t of tau minus t tau prime k1, right, and then the sine function t of tau minus t of tau prime. And all the others I leave the same. I, where I is larger than 1, I define them as this ki. So this thing is, you can think of it as a change of variables. This change of variables guarantees that this is aligned. And this change of variables, of course, mixes time and space. And of course, this thing is a Lorentz transformation. So the change of variables that I'm doing here is, if you want, a Lorentz transformation in k-space that aligns x and k, so that all the x lies on the zeroth component of k. All right? Now, oftentimes, this thing is done in field theory often. Oftentimes, people say, right, I do a Lorentz transformation on the integral, and they say, in the momentum space. I object to that, because people say, a transformation in momentum space. This thing is a dummy variable, right? Happens to be a Lorentz transformation, I agree. But it's a dummy variable. There's no physics associated with a Lorentz transformation under the integral sign. unless you start thinking of plane waves as something physical, and this is a sum of plane waves, and then you transform for all the plane waves. Sure, but those things are not physical. This is S-matrix kind of thinking. So when people talk about, I'm doing a Lorentz transformation in momentum space, I don't like it. Because it's just a change of variables that happens to be a Lorentz transformation under an integral sign on the dummy variable k. See what I mean? It depends. This is philosophy, if you want. Do you give physical value to the plane waves that are inside this integral, these plane waves? Do they have a physical value or not? If you believe they have a physical value, you say, well, I kind of Lorentz transform all those plane waves in momentum space, right? Okay, fair, whatever. Then think what the physics of a Lorentz transformation in momentum space is, because it's non-trivial. It's not a change of reference frame, no? Okay, you transform momentum space. And there's a symplectic space made by positions and momentum, and it's not trivial how they transform. Now, if you do not assign value to the plane waves, then this is just an integral that works. You know, definitely this is the Wyman function, and you do a change of variables that aligns k mu with x mu. Of course, it helps to know that this is a Lorentz transformation in momentum space, because then you know, of course, that this is the right thing to do, because it aligns this, and then there's going to be a Jacobian of the transformation that maybe can make things difficult, but you know it doesn't make things difficult, because you know that all these things is the invariant element of volume, and under this transformation that happens to be a Lorentz transformation is the same. Agreed, people? All right, so what we know is on this change of variables, dd plus 1 of k bar, not a vector, it's k bar, right? Theta of k0 d k mu bar k mu, it's equal to d plus 1. I should have written the equality the other way, it doesn't matter. K theta of k0 delta k mu. K mu. All right, so you know that this element of integration is invariant under the change of variables. Because you know it's invariant under Lorentz transformation. This happens to be a Lorentz transformation in momentum space. But I say that statement in a mathematical kind of sense, not in a physical kind of sense. We can discuss this if you want. Because this is a useful, in every book in quantum field theory, because in most books of quantum field theory, they're written by high energy people. And because they're written by high-energy physics people, they will talk about the physicality of this as a Lorentz transformation in momentum space and so on. If you want to discuss that, we can. All right, so let's apply. Now that we've set up this transformation, let's apply it. Let's see. Now I want this. So we can integrate this. We can do that integral. And we can do all the angular integrals first. We can do, okay, we do the k0 integral and the angular integrals. It's actually very easy to do the k0 integral and the angular integrals. No, the k0, my bad. We do all the angular integrals, and by angular, I mean all the spatial integrals. Let me just do it, minus the modulus. So the k0 is the one that I leave at the end. Let me just do it. Tau prime. So what I do, let me just tell you the steps. I change to do these integrals. I change to variables to this, okay? And I do the integrals on k1, k2, k3, and I'm left with k0 that happens to be equal, because this is a massless field, to, or related proportional, if you want, with a sign, depending who you are, it's with the modulus of k vector, okay? By doing that, we get the following. 4 pi minus d over 2 gamma d over 2. This is a geometric factor. This is the volume of the hypersphere of dimension d with pi's extra that come from the 2. OK, it's the volume of the hypersphere with these 2 times 2 pi cube. And then you get 0 infinity d modulus k, k d minus 2, e minus I, modulus k delta sine t of tau minus t tau prime. And that's equal. That's an integral that we can do immediately. It's an exponential times a polynomial, very easy integral. And what we get is gamma d minus 1 divided by 2 divided by 4 pi, yeah, d plus 1 divided by 2, right, and then delta sine of t of tau minus t of tau prime. All right, so that's what you get doing those integrals. After that change of variables, doing those integrals is trivial. Honestly, you can plug it into Mathematica, it gives you that immediately. All right, so this is a geometric factor, and this is the important bit. Geometric factors are usually not considered important in physics, right? Because they have no scales. Now, it's an issue, because we say all the time, we get quantum gravity effects at Planck scales, right? Well, true, dimensionless thing is Planck scales, but there might be a geometric factor. Geometric factors can be big. Geometric factors are basically products of 2 pi to the n times 2 to the n kind of thing, can be as big as that, usually, or n is the number of dimensions, or as small as 1 over that, right? And those things, is for 4 dimensions, this is of the order of 10 to the 5, right? So maybe quantum gravity physics starts at 10 to the 5 times the Planck scale, or 10 to the minus 5 times Planck scale, you know? And maybe there might be geometric factors, depending on the physical phenomenon you're considering. So it's non-trivial. That's why you could see maybe it was not unthinkable to see B-mode polarization, right, at 10 to the 5 times Planck scale. That is fine, because that could be the geometric factors being nice to us and putting quantum gravity within reach, you see? Unfortunately, it doesn't seem to be the case. But anyway, don't underestimate geometric factors, OK? That's all that I mean. They can be big numbers. 4 dimensions is too many dimensions already to neglect geometric factors. All right, so let's analyze what this is. Delta sine of t of tau minus t of tau prime, it's equal to, we substitute t of tau prime, which we have it here, OK? And if we substitute that, we get that this is 2a minus 1 sinh a over 2 tau minus tau prime. To get there, I use trigonometric identities. Sinh of x, well, hyperbolic trigonometric identities. Sinh of y, it's equal to twice cos x plus y divided by 2. Sinh x minus y divided by 2, and also cosh of x minus cosh of y is equal to 2 sinh x plus y divided by 2 sinh x minus y divided by 2. I use these two. You can use others. It's easy. It's trigonometric. You can do exponentials instead and get it. That's what you get. Using this, you get that. OK. Oh, did I forget the sign? No. No, actually, the sign disappears. The sign in this case is trivial because we already picked a direction for the transformation. All right, then we know that the Whiteman of delta tau, yeah, basically, you get the sign of this. Basically, if you get the sign of this times this, right, the delta tau has The sine of the sinh is the same as the sine of the difference, because the sinh is an odd function. Therefore, the two signs cancel. It's either plus plus or minus minus, so you can just remove it. Agreed? But I mean, you have the sine of this and then the sinh of the difference. So they have the same sign, so you just don't write the sine function. It's either plus plus or minus minus. So the W of delta tau is this geometric factor d minus 1 divided by 2. Oh, by the way, well, I'll write it here. 2 pi d plus 1 divided by 2, 1 over a sinh of a divided by 2, delta tau. How nice. So stationary, huh? Maybe if you don't know anything, that's unexpected. You're accelerating, right? But the Wyman function is stationary. It's invariant under proper time translations. I don't know if you should have expected that or not. Well, I mean, The vacuum is a Lorentz invariant state. You're doing integrated Lorentz transformation. So yeah, it should be Lorentz invariant. But then again, the result is that the Wyman function of the vacuum pulled back to the trajectory of an accelerated observer is stationary. Now the question is it also KMS? Let me do one more thing. One board short. I don't like that. Maybe I can do. This is a very cheeky trick. Okay, fair. All right, so let's see. Let me call, so this thing, let me call a geometric factor of D, right? It's a function of the dimensions. Maybe I should even call it J sub D. It's a geometric factor, G. All right, so let's evaluate delta tau plus I 2 pi A, right? This is to check the claim, right? This is the inverse temperature. Let's see what that is equal to. So this is the geometric factor. You can tell that no one ever uses this board because the chalk writes amazingly. Okay. So 1 over A. And then we get the sinh of A over 2 delta T, delta tau, plus I pi. Agreed, people? Agreed, everyone? I'm just substituting delta tau by delta tau plus I 2 pi over A. The A cancels, the 2 cancels, the pi is left. OK? Nice. Oh, nice. But then what is the sinh of something real plus I pi? Do you guys know? I mean, don't guess, only if you know. I know you can guess it for the result to work, but that kind of loses the magic.
Minus the sinh.
Yes. Let's quickly do it, right? This is e to the I x, e to the I pi, minus e to the minus I x, e to the minus I pi, divided by 2. Oh, this is minus 1, this is minus 1. So nice, this is just the minus sinh of, the sinh of minus x, the minus sinh of x, if you want, which is the same as the sinh of x, right? Because the sinh of minus x, sorry, because it's an odd function. Agreed, people? Well, that's all we need, because then this thing is equal to gd 1 over a sinh of a over 2 times minus tau, minus delta tau. Aha. So this is equal to the Wyman function of minus delta tau. So we get the complex antiperiodicity. There's one more thing to check. Is this holomorphic in the strip? People, well, you tell me. We have the sinh function. Is the sinh function holomorphic? It's super holomorphic, it's everywhere. It's an analytic function. Okay, so also is holomorphic everywhere. Which in particular is holomorphic in the strip that we need it to be holomorphic. There we go, so we prove with this the vacuum state of the field is KMS with respect to partial tau of a constantly accelerated observer with temperature T equals A over 2 pi. Maybe if we want to like show the world or something, we want to transform back from natural units to full dimensional units. That's easy because, A is a frequency in natural units. So I know for sure I'm going to make it at energy, still not fully, because in units that C is 1, but H bar is not. So if I multiply by H bar, this is a frequency. Oh, the 2 pi will still be there, of course. So let's write the 2 pi. If this were an energy, right? then I know that to transform it to a temperature, I divide by the Boltzmann constant, and then I get a temperature. Well, in full dimensional units, it's not quite an energy because this is not really a frequency. It's length divided by time square, but we make it a frequency by dividing by C. There you go. This thing is what we call the Andrew temperature. Okay? Which is the same as this, only natural units. So, because we proved that the vacuum state of the field is KMS with respect to constantly accelerated observers' time, that means that particle detectors that go on constantly accelerated trajectories thermalize to the Andrew temperature. There you go, the Andrew effect. There you go, the crazy effect where you get someone is inertial and they're observing the vacuum of the theory and they would say, I guess, if they're into quantum optics or high energy physics, no particles in here. But then someone that goes accelerating, he said, what do you mean? My particle detector goes crazy. It's actually click, 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 clicking with a high rate corresponding to the temperature associated with the acceleration sun. The particle content of a field state depends on who you ask, right? So maybe we should abandon talking about the particle content of the field. I don't know, just a suggestion. But the whole point, the cool point, is that the detector thermalizes. Now, this removes all the controversial statements about the Andrew effect that came from the derivation that you're doing in the tutorials. All the problems of, but you need infinite time acceleration. Oh, but then you cannot do this because the inner product is... No, hold on. It's fine. Because now I remove that problem by taking really a thermometer. So I'm now defining the Andrew effect. The Andrew effect, instead of defining it with Bogoliubov transformations or anything, I say, you get a thermometer. Make sure that the thermometer, when it's inertial, marks zero. So you're in the ground state. Accelerate that thermometer, and the thermometer thermalizes to the Andrew temperature. By the way, if the background state of the field is thermal and not zero temperature, would be something else, same would happen, right? Because physically what happens, you can prove it rigorously, but what would happen is the thermal state with respect to time t of temperature capital T, right? As you accelerate, you become more and more relativistic, and then basically the UV frequencies, the right movers, so the things that move in the direction of motion, get blue shifted, and the ones that move in the opposite direction get red shifted. So you're going to be reshifted away from the peak of the thermal radiation that you have, right? And in the end, it's going to look like the vacuum. And in the end, after a long time, long enough, you will just see the Andrew temperature, not the thermal temperature of the background. Anyway, so there you go, the Andrew effect. By the way, if you ask Andrew nowadays, Andrew would tell you, what's the Andrew effect? Oh, it's the thermal response of a detector that is constantly accelerated. Because Andrew, and this goes all the way back to a paper of Andrew and Wald, where they say, Rindler modes really, I mean, I'm paraphrasing, I'm not quoting, but they do say things totally in this spirit. Rindler modes don't really make sense at all until there's someone there to detect them. So you need detectors in order to talk about particles. And to talk about the Andrew effect, you need to introduce particle detectors. So it's super important that this is the definition of the Andrew effect and not anything related to Bogoliubov transformations. This goes against many textbook approaches to the Andrew effect, even reviews written about the Andrew effect, not by Andrew, where they say that the Andrew effect is this Bogoliubov transformation that gives you, that squeezes the vacuum into a two-mode squeeze state and therefore trace one and you get thermality in the field state. No. For the Andrew effect is a phenomenological prediction of quantum field theory. It requires detectors. That's my opinion. That's also Andrew's opinion and Wald's opinion. We can discuss about it. This is robust. There are many advantages to this. This is robust, as in, like, what if the trajectory is not accelerated forever? It's only for a long time. Fine, no problem with this. This is robust under that, unlike the Bogoliubov definition. And I think with this, we finish the part of the course about the Andrew effect. Any questions? Yes?
If you don't start with the vacuum state for the inertial observer, but instead with a KMS state,
yep.
It's accelerating.
KMS state, do you need to specify with respect to whose time?
For an inertial
observer. Yes.
With some temperature.
Yeah.
If you then consider an accelerated observer, does it like increase the temperature?
No, same temperature. Exactly the same. And that's what I tried to tell you. Maybe I wasn't clear enough. What's going on with the... So imagine that you have an inertial observer with a detector coupled to the thermal state with respect to himself, right? To themselves. So you go on that proper time like this. And what do you see? Oh, you see a thermal distribution. So basically, the modes that most contribute to your response are the modes on the gap kind of thing. So you see the thermal distribution on the frequency of the peak of the temperature, right? It's the Planckian distribution, and you're seeing that. Now, if you start accelerating with respect to that, you become more and more relativistic, and you start blue shifting and red shifting the field modes, right? The one that they're in a thermal state, you transform the thermal state, so the modes that are moving in the direction of your acceleration, those modes are going to be blue shifted. The modes that move opposite to your acceleration are going to be red shifted. When you blue shift and red shift, you're taking them away of the window of resonance of the omega of the detector. The omega of the detector, so say that the detector is tuned, so this is your Planckian distribution. Excuse my Planckian. Right? And this here is the omega of the detector. So you have the detector tuned to the thermal state, to see thermality, right? And then you say, okay, what happens as I increase my acceleration? Well, this is omega, right? So the modes that move in that way are gonna be blue shifted that way. The mode that move opposite to the acceleration are gonna be red shifted away, out of the window that the detector will see. Remember, when the detector is interacting for a long time, it kind of narrows the spectral response, okay? And you get the Wyman only on one frequency. So as that happens, right, you're seeing the response go down and go down and go down to that thermal state, but then it's looking more like this kind of response that what you have for the vacuum. You're coupled to modes that are almost not excited by the original thermal state as you become very relativistic. So yeah, there's a paper that computes it, okay? You can do it rigorously, and you see that. But hand-wavily, that's what happens. As you accelerate, you get blue-shifted and red-shifted away from the thermal distribution. And that's true for any finite spectrum state, right? If you prepare whatever state you want, even something that is not thermal, a one-photon state of a particular frequency distribution, well, as you accelerate, you're going to be blue-shifted away and red-shifted away from that. And if you wait for short times, you're going to see the difference because you see all the whole spectrum, right? But as you wait for infinite times, your response is constrained by the Fourier transform of your switching that becomes narrower and narrower and narrower. And then you will be blue shifted away and red shifted away after long times from any state that you prepare. So yeah, if it's already a thermal state, the temperature is the same. You eventually thermalize with an Andrew temperature. It's because of the long time assumption, right? It all depends on scales. Do you accelerate long enough to blue shift the distribution or not? More questions, but good question. Yeah, I tried to say that very fast, maybe. More questions, yep.
So what you're saying is that even in a very hot quantum field, you could accelerate extremely slowly for a very long time to effectively cool a detector to almost zero temperature?
Yes. Oh my God, yes. You can blue shift yourself away. I mean, you see, that in the classical intuition, that wouldn't even be surprising, right? Because in the classical intuition, there's no Andrew effect. So you just blue shift yourself away from anything that's in the field. The whole point here is that the response of the detector is convoluted with the Fourier transform of the switching. So if you wait enough time, it's going to be very narrow. The window is very narrow. And of course, if you also accelerate, if you change your state of motion, you're going to blue shift and redshift away anything that you prepare in the field. So for long enough time, you will blue shift and redshift away anything that perturbs the Andrew effect. A different thing is that if you have something that is kind of flat in frequencies, yeah, that's a different story. But any state that has a bandwidth, if you want, of some kind, doesn't have to be compact support, right? How symmetric that looks shouldn't be. Anyway, sorry about that. This is supposed to be a Planckian. Questions? Okay. Did you know about, so some of you knew about the Andrew effect already. How many people did not know about the Andrew effect before today? You're nice. You're a very red class. Very nice. All right, so the next thing we're going to see, and that will be tomorrow, is entanglement harvesting. So we're going to talk about how to extract correlations from the vacuum state with particle detectors.